21st Century Neuroscience, from lab to clinic to home, school, and office. That's the title of a lecture at Rockhurst University in Kansas City. The presenter is Dr. Martha Farah, one of the world's most prominent cognitive neuroscientists, and the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of Natural Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Farah joins us now on the Bioethics Channel. Martha, your title implies neuroscience has uses in more places than the lab. Could you explain generally how neuroscience has applications in the home, school, and office?
Well, so the thing about contemporary neuroscience is that we have now gotten to the point where we can explain a certain amount of human behavior, why people act as they do, the relationships they form, the feelings they have, the behavior they're likely to engage in. And understanding those things helps you, whether you are a business person trying to negotiate a deal, promote a product, whether you're a teacher trying to educate children, whatever your goal in life is, likely as not, it involves understanding behavior, predicting behavior, and oftentimes trying to improve it. So neuroscience, now that we can explain something about human behavior, I don't want to oversell what we can do at this point, but, you know, we're getting there. We know something about why people behave as they do, and that knowledge turns out to be very useful in all of these different contexts.
Well, talk about then a non-medical problem, for example, where neuroscience can be applied.
Okay. Well, one example comes from, in fact, business and specifically marketing. For decades, businesses have used methods like focus groups to try to figure out what kind of product will sell well, what kind of advertising campaign will help people, you know, buy more of your product. And typically, you know, they would sit down with a group of people and a skilled interviewer would, question the sample that they have there in the focus group to find out, like, you know, how do they feel about this product? What would they like to see different about it? And so forth. You can find a lot out about, you know, what people want, what they want to buy that way. But there certainly are some things that you can't find out so well. There's some things that people may not want to admit to you. There's some things that people may not even know themselves. A lot of our behavior, in fact, is kind of opaque to ourselves. The idea behind a new method in marketing called neuromarketing is that by studying people's brain reactions to products, packaging, you know, advertising campaigns, and so forth, you can get additional useful information about what will make somebody want to buy your product.
So this is something almost like you might see in a movie or on TV where people are almost hooked up, their brains are hooked up to MRIs almost, and you can see how their brain changes with the different colors. Am I making something up there, or does that relate closely to what you're talking about?
No, that's very much the kind of thing I'm talking about. So there are some companies that use functional MRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, to monitor brain function as people, you know, look at products and see, possible advertising messages and so forth. There are also a lot of companies that use a cheaper, easier, more portable methodology called electroencephalography or event-related potentials. Those are two sort of variants of basically the same method that just involves putting little electrodes on the scalp. You know, it's non-invasive, and looking at changes in brainwave as a function of, you know, what the potential customer is looking at.
Or whatever a candidate and his or her messaging might be and what might work.
Yes, and you mentioned candidate. It actually is true that some neuromarketing firms offer advice to political candidates. So it's not just about selling, you know, your laundry soap. It's about selling political candidates. It's even about selling good health behaviors, you know, public service messages, trying to persuade people to try to quit smoking or, you know, do other healthy or pro-social behaviors. For all of these reasons, we need to understand, like, what will make a persuasive message. And neuromarketing seems to be able to offer some help there.
During your presentation, your lecture here in Rockhurst, one of the things that you're going to talk about is how we view ourselves as brains and how that can challenge our notions of moral responsibility and spirituality. And that prompted a couple of questions on my part. You know, I never thought that we view our brains in one way or the other. How do we view ourselves as brains in the first place?
Well, you know, it's tough. I mean, I guess the answer is we view ourselves as brains with difficulty. It's very unnatural to think of ourselves that way. You know, I think most people intuitively feel that every person has a physical component, you know, the body that you can look at and touch and weigh, and then a non-physical component, the mind, some people might call it the soul. And I think that is a very natural way to think about a human being. But when we look at what modern neuroscience is learning, part of what it's learning is that the things that the non-physical part of a person seems to do, you know, thinking, feeling, personality, moral reasoning, all those things that we would normally want to, excuse me, attribute to the soul or the self or the mind, those all seem to be functions of the brain. And what I mean by that is, if you study the brain using brain imaging, for example, you can see the physical correlates of those processes, you know, thinking, feeling, and so forth. And if you actually, you know, for people who have lost some bit of brain that normally does those things, you know, through some naturally occurring accident or disease process, they no longer are able to do those things. So, you know, someone who has, you know, damage to certain emotional areas of the brain may not experience those emotions anymore. So I mention that to sort of demonstrate that it's not just that there is, you know, that there's sort of brain processes that go along for the ride when the real cause of these mental and physical states, mental and emotional states is non-physical. But it looks like those brain processes are actually part and parcel of those mental and emotional states. And if that bit of brain that carries them out isn't there, then they're not there.
So then someone, say, who might suffer a stroke or a brain injury from a car accident, something like that, they're parts of their brain that have to do with moral responsibility, as an example, or spirituality might be affected, and they act differently as a result.
Yes, yeah, well put. So, for example, there are people who, after brain damage, become quite antisocial. They do things that are inconsiderate, that are cruel, that are immoral. And that's, you know, yet more evidence that these things about a person that we kind of naturally, intuitively attribute to a non-material part of the person, whether you want to call it the mind or the soul, really seem to be part of the physical brain.
So with this knowledge, that this somewhat opens up a box of ethical questions, does it not, about what we should do with this information, what's safe, what's fair, what's morally acceptable, right?
Yes, I agree. There are a whole slew of issues that follow from this. I'll give you a few for examples here. I mean, one is, if everything you do is a function of your brain, and that's a physical system, then everything you do is kind of inevitable. I mean, you know, physics is a deterministic system, and, you know, your brain was, let's say, hypothetically, was wired up to go commit a murder because of the physical circumstances, you know, that gave rise to the genes that you inherited and the experiences that you grew up with. And so, whatever somebody does, it seems as if you should be able to say, well, I couldn't help it. You know, it was just a result of my brain function. So one big question that this raises is, you know, how do we hang on to some conception of moral responsibility if we think of ourselves as just brains?
What about the fact that we could use a lot of different kinds of medications to, I guess it would be fair to say, influence behavior? It say with boys and girls with ADHD and the medication that could be applied to that kind of circumstance. And there are other situations where medications can be used to influence behavior. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. And, you know, in a way, you can look at that as just one more bit of evidence that people's personalities, their behaviors, whether they're responsible or not, whether they're impulsive or careful, that this all comes down to the chemistry of our brains. Now, you know, from a practical point of view, there are some very good things that follow from that. For example, you know, there are medications that really help people who have problems with conduct, personality, and so forth. So you know, practically, we can put this to some very good use. But it also raises these big philosophical questions that are very puzzling.
So what can we anticipate in the future? What does the future hold with the knowledge that we have now, the knowledge that we're likely to gain in the future? What will that mean?
Well, I mean, I think one trend that we can pretty much see now is that people are thinking of themselves more as brains. There is, you know, growing acceptance just over, you know, the last few decades of the idea that mental illness has biological roots. If you just read, you know, newspapers and magazines, you see a lot more, you know, feature stories on, you know, the neural bases of this or that personality trait. So I think we're gonna see more, you know, sort of the popular consciousness kind of being aware of this brain basis that we all share. I think in terms of neurotechnologies for helping our brains, we can look forward to some interesting, possibly very helpful alternatives to medication. Things like brain stimulation that either stimulate parts of the brain from outside the head, so they're non-invasive, or actually what's called deep brain stimulation, where you actually implant machinery in people's heads to stimulate parts of the brain. These are obviously, you know, very major medical procedures, the implanted devices, but for people who have major medical psychiatric problems, they can be very helpful. So, you know, we'll be learning a lot in the coming decades about how to heal mental illnesses, how to, you know, hopefully bring out the best in all of us, and you know, I have to say, hopefully not go overboard trying to, I don't know, make everybody's brain the same, and, you know, hopefully we can still respect differences and individuality while we're at it.
Dr. Martha Farah is the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of Natural Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. She will present a lecture entitled 21st Century Neuroscience from Lab to Clinic to Home, School, and Office at Rutgers University in Kansas City on September the 19th. For more information, visit rockhurst.edu. That's rockhurst.edu. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.